The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
From a 9-year-old business that's shaking things up to one that's 90 years old this year, Faber & Faber was founded by our next guest's grandfather. Toby Faber tells his grandfather's story in a book called Faber & Faber, The Untold Story. Toby, obviously your grandfather went on to have a very successful career in publishing, but that's not where it started. Paint a picture for us of his beginnings.
His beginnings, well, they began, I suppose it could be said, in failure. First of all, failure as a publisher. He wasn't a great success in the 2 years he spent at Oxford University Press before the First World War. Then, of course, he went off to fight in the war. But then more failure in the sense that he joined the family brewing business, which was owned by, I think, second cousins. And he was sacked from that after a couple of years. Again, I don't think he was that good at brewing. And that means he was at a loose end in the early 1920s when he started thinking about going back into publishing.
And he was something of a risk taker, is it fair to say, at that point in his life in terms of borrowing monies from the family trust to really follow his instinct?
That's right. He makes contact with another fellow of All Souls whose wife owns this share in a business called the Scientific Press. And the Scientific Press is making huge amounts of money because of its main publication, which was the Nursing Mirror, which is still going. And the Guires thought it would be nice to diversify into other areas. And they went into business, my grandfather, to do that. He had that combination of business background and an All Souls Fellowship, which is essential for any successful publisher. And then my grandfather bought out another small shareholder, essentially, as you say, borrowing money from a family trust to do that. Money he didn't have, gambling that he could make a go of this business when he bought into it. And it changed its name to Faber & Guire.
And he goes on then to create Faber & Faber. What was the thinking behind that name?
Thinking behind the name was that two Fabers are better than one. Or one of his recruits, he had two important early recruits. One of them was Richard de la Mare, who was the son of the poet Walter de la Mare. And supposedly it was Walter de la Mare who, when my grandfather was left in sole control of this business, having managed to buy out the Guires, said, well, you can't have too much of a good thing. Why not call it Faber & Faber? I mean, the truth is, of course, it's good early branding, isn't it? It just sounds more solid, Faber & Faber, than plain old Faber.
So there was only ever one Faber & Faber & Faber. Your grandfather at that point, he seemed to have quite a reputation for recruiting talent. And one of the first people that he brought in within his ranks was T.S. Eliot. For most people, they'll be familiar with T.S. Eliot, of course, as a world-renowned poet and playwright. But he had something of a business brain as well. What was the relationship like between the two?
It was immensely strong. So Eliot had already written The Wasteland, of course. He absolutely had this reputation as a poet. He was working as editor of this magazine called The Criterion, which is a literary magazine, which was what first brought him to my grandfather, who was thinking he might start his own, but then realised he didn't need to. But what my grandfather really liked about Eliot was at the time he was working at Lloyds Bank. He was in the international department of Lloyds Bank. So he had that business brain, and that was important to him.
And there was obviously a relationship of huge trust between the two. Eliot bringing incredible talent, bringing his friends and network in. And obviously he shaped a lot of the 20th century literature that we're familiar with today. But he did pass up some masterpieces in terms of Ulysses and Animal Farm. As you've looked back on that period of time, how do you think your grandfather made his peace with those misses?
Well, he was sad about Ulysses. He was very much involved in that decision. The whole firm wanted to publish Ulysses, but we were frightened by the obscenity within it. In fact, they got legal advice that if we published Ulysses, then the chairman, that is to say my grandfather, would be sent to prison for 6 months. And that is why they passed on it. Bodley Head were braver and leapt in and published it. We still had this relationship with Joyce, of course. We published Finnegan's Wake. Joyce had a mixed relationship with Faber & Faber. He had his own version of our name. He called us Feebler and Fumbler. but he did in the end stick with us. As you say, I mean, Joyce ended up one of the heights on the list, but we missed out on Ulysses, and we hugely regret that. George Orwell. Eliot rejected Orwell not once, but twice. First at the beginning of his career for Down and Out in Paris and London, and then towards the end, when Eliot is quite good friends with Orwell because they've been broadcasting together on the BBC, and Orwell sends him Animal Farm. And Eliot rejects it in a letter that I think you just have to sympathise with, really, because he's rejecting it in July 1944, so when the Second World War's at its height, And what he says is, I really like this book, but I just don't think that we can publish it at a time like this. It's because it's being critical of Soviet Russia.
You mentioned there that Joyce went on to work with Faber and Faber through the Finnegan's Wake book. There was also a strong Irish connection in general through the years with Muldoon, Beckett, McNeice. You know, how critical has that Irish connection been? What was the relationship like with Eliot and Joyce, for example?
That relationship has been critical. I mean, it's really interesting when you look at the really strong names on the Faber backlist, how many of them are Irish. And it starts, as you say, with Eliot and his relationship with Joyce, people like Louis McNeice in those early years. And then in the early 50s, my grandfather makes another brilliant recruit, a man called Charles Monteith, who was an Ulsterman who brought his own Irish contacts to bear. Famously, Charles Monteith, almost his first act as an editor at Faber and Faber, was to take on William Golding to rescue Lord of the Flies from the slush pile, where it had already been rejected by another Faber reader. Now, of course, he's not Irish, but then Monteith very quickly goes on to realise there's a revolution happening in playwriting, so he takes on Samuel Beckett. He spots John McGowan in the early 60s, Seamus Heaney. Seamus Heaney brings us Paul Muldoon. It's a chain that goes right through.
And Seamus Heaney famously said that hearing from Faber when he was trying to get his debut collection published, it was like getting a letter from God. Such was the prestige and honour of Faber and Faber. You mentioned John McGowan there as well. I know your book and collection has some very funny anecdotes there about that relationship.
Well, it does, because McGowan has written his book, The Barracks, which he sends to Faber, and Charles Monteith replies saying, brilliant, we love it. I do think you need to be aware that some of the language in it is likely to get you banned both by provincial booksellers in the UK, this is in the early 1960s, and in the Republic of Ireland. John McGowan then replies a letter, and I hope this is not too fruity language for your show. But
you can asterisk it for us.
Okay, saying in the letter, but he says it in full in the letter, I've gone through all the F words. I think I can do away with all of them except for four, which are absolutely crucial to the tone of the book. And then Faber and Faber have to be brave about publishing this. And we decided we will be, and we go ahead and we send it off to the printers, and then the printers asterisk it out because they're not being brave. So again, we have to tell the printers to do it. And it does eventually come out, and I'm afraid it does lead to quite a big fallout in Ireland, especially that book, and then McGowan's next book, The Dark, I think was properly banned in the Republic.
And Faber and Faber today, it's 90 years old. It has, you know, remained an independent publishing house. It's been said by one agent, I know, that, you know, in Faber you can seem commercial, you don't have to wear a monocle. And I know T.S. Eliot had the motto that with some books you're aiming to make as much money as possible. With poetry, you are aiming to lose as little as possible. What does the business look like today?
The business is in really good health at the moment. We're a small enough business that what matters to us most from year to year is just how good our list is. And this year we've had an amazing list. And again, it goes back to the Irish connection. In particular, Anna Burns with Milkman, the most recent Booker Prize winner. And also Sally Rooney is published by Faber, and she's obviously been a huge seller. So it's nice to see that carrying on. And that means we've had, for the last 2 or 3 years, we've had tremendous results.
Fantastic. Toby Faber, author of Faber and Faber, The Untold Stories, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.